I studied for it. I never knew what I studied, but I studied it my whole third class. You know, threatening allegations. I gave it. I gave it.
We're not going to have a test.
No. Not today.
We are going to have a test, but not today.
How come? We can't get an extra chapter class, so I'm going to have to put, give you two tests in one day.
It'll be just a big final, you know.
John didn't think it was important enough for the class. Yeah. I think we will be able to cover all the material. It's just that I won't be able to cover it before the test. We have to have another hour after the test.
What's the test then going to be?
Next Friday.
Next Friday?
Yeah. And we have another Friday after that, but, you know, so we'll finish lecturing on the Friday after that. I'm going to have to knock off a few, give you credit on a few questions that I definitely won't get a chance to cover, but I think it'll be all right. We will get to cover the information, and that's an important thing.
Is the final going to be on material from this point up until the last?
It'll be on material from the last test up until where we get today. How far we get today. I'll explain it to you.
Okay, let's get started here. I told most of the class that that will not be today because we can't get an extra chapel class. So what I'm going to have to do is today, we'll lecture today, and how far we get today, I'm going to give you two tests next time. Well, actually, it'll be only one test. It'll be about one and a half, so to speak. I'll give you the test I was going to give you today, plus the final exam, but I'm going to eliminate some questions on the final exam because we won't get to them. And then we'll cover the rest of the material of the last lecture period. And so just be studying your notes from the last quiz up until how far we get today. And where we get today will be the last, you'll be responsible for all the information up until where we get today. Okay?
And so we get the test next Friday?
Next Friday is the final exam. That's the only test we'll have. It'll be actually a combination of two tests there. And it'll be next Friday. And then we'll have a Friday after that, but that won't be a test. That'll be finishing up lecture.
Is the final on the front part again, too?
No. The final exam will cover, we'll be responsible for everything from the last test. Don't even worry about anything before the last test. But from the last test up. I think there might be a few questions on the final of a real general nature on the earlier stuff, you know, just some real outstanding things, but nothing in detail. So you might want to look over your notes for the first part, but spend your time studying for the
since the last test. There may be some general things on the material before, but it wouldn't be anything really. Most of it's just since that time. Yes.
Next Friday's the 14th.
14th? Okay. Next Friday's the 14th. But I think it'll work out good that way. That way we'll get through all the information. And I'm not sure yet. Depending on how far we get today, I'll give you two grades that way. You know, so if you both want to do good on the other, or I'll just make combine it as one grade depending on how far we get. If I combine it as one grade, it'll count double what your other test counted. So, you know, be diligent and steady for this last one. It'll be important. Okay, let's have word for it then.
Mike, mm-hmm. Where did we leave off last time?
What do you mean?
Sod and Gomorrah?
Yes, I think. Let me check.
Yes,
I think it's going to start right with Sod and Gomorrah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Starting with from Sod and Gomorrah and on. You're responsible.
I'm sorry. Right.
Okay.
How
about this on that page? All right, let's have a word for everyone. Lord, we ask you to bless the Father today. Lord, we thank you for your word. Lord, we rejoice in you this morning, O God, for the blessings you've bestowed upon us. Lord, I pray that you continue to be with us throughout the rest of the class, O God. Continue to bless us and teach us, O Lord, and cause us to rejoice in you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Okay, today we're going to begin with the Canaanite religion. Canaanite religion. What was the Canaanite religion like? We've talked about the Exodus and the Israelites coming out of Egypt, coming into Canaan's land. We talked about the destruction of Jericho and a few other cities last time. And, of course, the liberals and the atheists charged God with cruelty and injustice in commanding Joshua to destroy the Canaanites, man, woman, and child. He said, destroy them all. And you can look that up in Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 5. It gives you the account of what God told them to do. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 to 5 for the reference. But God told them to go in and destroy man, woman, and child, destroy all the Canaanites, and immediately the liberals, you know, the humanists, you know, championing their cause of, you know, human freedom and all of this, they say, what a cruel, hard God that was, and the cruel Israelites, and God is evil, and all this kind of thing, and charging God, pointing the finger against God for what he did. But archaeology has shed some light on what the Canaanites were like, and it makes that command a lot more understandable. When you see what the Canaanites were like, you can understand why God wanted them wiped out. Because just for mercy on their sake, even, the corruptness that they had attained unto, if God would allow them to live longer, they're just piling up more sins to be accountable for in judgment. So it's in the mercy of God to cut them off in their sin. Now, most of the information I'm bringing you here comes from the Rosh Shamra tablets. And we talked about those a little bit earlier when they were discovered. Remember those, the Rosh Shamra tablets? They were discovered at a place called Rosh Shamra, or also Ugaritic tablets are also referred to. I don't think we have a map that shows the location of where they were found, but it's up in the northern part here, Palestine. You can probably find it on a map someplace. They may have the name of it. Well, I guess I'm going to try to spend the time trying to find it, but it is in that location, that area. Now, the Canaanite religion, of course, was grossly polytheistic. These Rosh Shamra tablets tell us a lot about the religion and the way they worshiped and so forth. And we'll go through a few of these things, and you'll notice that there's a number of contradictions here, but don't worry about it, because that's the way almost all pagan religions are. And the doctrine of the Trinity is no exception. But El was the head of the pantheon. Now, this is not the same god as Yahweh. It's El, but they use the same term for it. But this was actually the name of a god in the pantheon of the Canaanite religion. Now, El happens to simply be the word for God in both of these languages. They're both Semitic languages. They're related languages, so you're going to have similarities in the language. And of course, the liberals say that the Israelites got it from the Canaanites, but that's foolishness.
What's the difference between the pantheon and
Pantheon refers to the whole system of gods. Like we talk about the Greco-Roman pantheon, means all their gods, their whole system of gods. And so he's the head of it. He's the head of all their gods. He would be like Jupiter is in the Roman gods. He's the head of the whole system of gods. See, they had many, many gods. And pantheon, pan comes from all, and it means all, and theon means God. So it's all the gods. So it's just a general term for the whole religious system. So we see here, this is probably a degeneracy from the true God, because of course all the peoples in that area once worshipped the true God once they came out of the ark and Noah and so forth, and after the Tower of Babel, and as they spread out, they probably, you know, kept the same term for God, but now they've got this other God and got polytheism involved. So it's probably one of the reasons for the similarity of terms. Now El was a bloody tyrant with three wives, which were also his sisters.
Wow.
He's a bloody tyrant of a god, and he had three wives. There's that magic number three again, which were also his sisters. And he dethroned his father, who was Uranus. You've heard that there's a planet named after Uranus, but Uranus is also another Roman and Greek god. So, but Uranus was El's father. El dethroned him, and he took his sisters for wives, apparently. He murdered his favorite son and decapitated his daughter. These are all gods, see, doing all this. But he murdered his favorite son, El did. So he took care of his father and his favorite son, and he decapitated his daughter. Sounds kind of like Herod the Great.
Yeah.
He's out of the class.
Decapitated?
Decapitated. In other words, chopped off her head. Decapitated.
Whose son was it?
It was El's son. No, El dethroned his father, and he murdered his favorite son. He apparently had other sons. We'll talk about Baal as one of his other sons. So, and he decapitated his daughter. Now, the Ugaritic poems, these Rosh Hashanah tablets, well, I guess I'll put that term down. It's also called Ugaritic tablets, just because of two different names at the same place at a different time. Ugaritic poems are the most sensuous and perverted in Near Eastern literature. They're by far the champions for pervertedness and sensuousness of all Eastern literature tablets that they've ever discovered. And they describe in detail El's seduction of two women, probably two human women. And of course, the gods and these pagan religions, the gods and always had intercourse with human beings and some of this kind of thing. And so it describes in detail his seduction of two women. Imagine a kind of god like that to be the god of your pantheon, to be the god you worship, the head of all the gods. Now, El supposedly was the father of man and the father of the gods. He's the father of all man, and the father of the gods. He's the creator, he's the, you know, the high god, and here he is seducing women and all this kind of thing, killing off everybody in sight. But he's the father of the gods, and of man and of gods. Now, Baal was the son of El. Baal was the son of El. Should probably be a counterfeit of Christ. And he was the reigning king of the gods, El's successor. Now, we're not sure whether El died and turned it over to him, but Baal was the reigning king of the gods, and I don't know if they had El die off and he took over, or whether El was there too, but at different times they worshiped Baal and so forth as the king of the reigning king of the gods. Because El was called the father of the gods and the father of man, but Baal was called the king of the gods, and he's supposedly the son of El. Now, Baal was also the storm god, the giver of rain and all fertility. So you can see when Elijah had the rain stop for 3.5 years, Baal wasn't coming through very well there with his rain and fertility. So Baal was the storm god, and apparently I've heard other places he was also the fire god too, but there's no problem there. There's so many different things. In fact, here's another piece of confusion. Baal is also called the son of Dagon, the fish god. So whether he's the son of El or the son of Dagon, you know, apparently he's the son of both, depending on where you are. Or this may be different traditions or different aspects of things. But he's also called the son of Dagon, the grain god or the fish god. He's called sometimes the grain god, the god of grain, the god of the harvest and so forth, and also the fish god. Dagon, the fish god. This is what the Philistines were worshiping. Remember Dagon, the image of Dagon, when they took the ark into the temple of Dagon and came back the next morning and Dagon had fallen down before the ark, and they put him back up again the next morning and fallen down and broken in pieces for the ark of God. So this is Dagon. Mm-hmm.
So in the Bible, when we see Baal, it's always referring to this image?
Well, it's not necessarily an image. It's referring to this god of the Canaanites, who was the son of El or the son of Dagon, and he's the king of their gods, and the son of these other gods. So to the Baal that's being referred to in the scriptures, you know, when they worship Baal, so for one after Baal. And probably the concept of Baal probably changed a bit over time, too. Now that may be what's involved here. It may be first considered the son of El, and then later of Dagon, because look, Dagon comes in about the time of David with the Philistines. So the Philistines were just another part of this whole Canaanite system. Now, Baal's wife and sister was known by different names in different places. Apparently, he married his sister, too, taking after his father. Now, here's another situation where we have three again. It's not known for sure whether he had three wives or whether he had one wife who had three different names. We're not sure, but there are three different women in his life, you might say, his wife, and their names are all similar. One is Anath, the other is Ashtoreth, or Ashtaroth. See, it's spelled both ways. And Asherah. So they don't know for sure whether this is three different wives or whether it's one wife who appears with different names in different places. Some Canaanites, some groups of Canaanites might call her by one name and others by another name, or it could be three wives. But all three of these, or one of these, whichever the case is, were goddesses of sex and war. And the idea of sex here is mainly in lust and sensuality, perverted, twisted things. So they're goddesses of lust, sensuality, and war, violence, and murder. See, this is what their whole thing was taken up with: war, murder, lust, violence, and you know, and also the perverted sexual things, homosexuality, and with animals and everything else. They were, you know, completely depraved. Now, Anath was called Virgin and Holy One as the sacred prostitute. She's the sacred prostitute. She's called the Virgin and the Holy One. That sacred virgin that we see appearing later on in history, too. I know the church we won't mention. But Holy One, the sacred prostitute, she was pictured as a naked woman upon a lion with a lily in her hand, in one hand, and a serpent in the other hand. So this is the image of her. She was a naked woman upon a lion, sitting upon a lion, with a lily in one hand, so it was supposed to symbolize sex and fertility, and a serpent in the other hand, which is quite appropriate to the type. Imagine, you know, the worship, everything's involved in this. It's hard to believe. So this was Anath, but it probably could involve all of these, Ashtoreth and Asherah, probably all pictured by the same image.
The serpent represented the devil?
Well, to them, see, serpents represent like with Gene Dixon, you know, it's a symbol of wisdom and knowledge and this kind of thing, see. But to us, you know, the proper symbol is the devil. And it's interesting that the devil's people will pick appropriate symbols for themselves. Like the goat, for example. The goat is used in Satan worship all the time. It's one of their chief symbols in the serpent. And it's quite fitting of type. I think that the Lord has just, you know, kind of allowed it to happen that way so that they accurately represent themselves in most cases.
That's where the five-pointed star came from, the goat though.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I've heard the five-pointed star was another one that they used.
Wow.
That's right. That's right. Because when they're in it, you know, they're proud of it. See, they're proud of their symbolism. But see, everything was involved in violence and murder, and of course the lily there. You know, the Easter lilies for Easter and so forth. That's all come from this idea of it was fertility worship. See, that's the Easter eggs. The eggs symbolizing fertility and life and things like this. You know, in the springtime, and it comes from worshiping all of their fertility gods, the rabbit, Easter bunny. The rabbit's one of the most prolific animals, you know, as far as offspring. It's famous for that, and that's, again, a symbol of fertility. So all those came in through the same source. You can see these connections, you know, they just line right up all the way down in history. Okay. Now, they had both male prostitutes and female prostitutes involved in their worship. Both male and female prostitutes involved in their worship. The male prostitutes were called sodomites. They don't use the term today.
They had both male and female worship?
No, male and female prostitutes involved in worship.
Right.
And these sexual orgies and so forth that they took place. And it involved homosexuality and heterosexuality, and apparently, from what I understand, with animals and everything. just anything that was, you know, the more depraved, the better. And of course, when you've got gods like that, you know, they're just probably trying to obey and be like the gods. Now, Anath, this one that we talked about with the, that was symbolized with the woman on the lion with the serpent in the hand and so forth, she appears in the Ugaritic epic, in one of these Ugaritic epic poems in the Rosh Hashanah tablets. She appears fiendishly butchering mankind for an unknown reason, and wading in human blood and remains with delight up to her throat, all the while exulting sadistically. Just a fiendish, you know, butchering of mankind for no reason, and then she's just wallowing in the blood and the remains of human beings and delighting in it right up to her throat, all the while exulting sadistically. Just a unbelievable thing. And here's that feminine worship there, too, the female deities.
Virgin, the Holy One.
Right. The Virgin, the Holy One doing that. She's the sacred prostitute. She's called a virgin. It's a, you know, everything's twisted and turned and distorted. Now, there are a lot of other deities also worshipped by the Canaanites, but these are the ones that are characteristic, and these are the ones that the Israelites got involved in later on in history. And it wasn't because of the Israelites thought that these Baal and Asherah were really gods. They probably got involved because of the sensuality and the lust involved, the lust of the flesh. This is the way they worship their gods, is in all these orgies and things, and that appeal to the flesh. So that's probably what the main temptation was. And a lot of them claimed still believe in Yahweh while they were doing all this. Now, some more on the Canaanites. That Gezer, which is one of the towns in Palestine, that Gezer, in 1904 to 1909, McAllister was excavating this place. McAllister excavated in 1904-1909 this town of Gezer and found the ruins of a Canaanite high place, one of their high places where they went to worship the gods. They went up in the high places to worship the gods. He found the remains of a Canaanite high place dating from about 1500 BC, which should be about 100 years before the conquest. 100 years before Joshua and the others came in, so 1500 BC. And he found the ruins of a temple where Baal and Ashtoreth were worshipped. The remains of a temple where Baal and Ashtoreth were worshipped. And this temple area was an area of about 150 by 120 feet, surrounded by a wall and open to the sky. It had no roof on it, it was open to the sky. So it was 150 feet. There's a wall around it. It's open to the sky. This area where they were worshiping.
That is Asherah and
Baal and Asherah. Okay. Both of them. Now inside this area were 10 stone pillars, from 5 to 11 feet tall. So kind of scattered around here. There were 10 stone pillars from 5 to 11 feet tall where sacrifices were offered. And they were offering human sacrifices too. So they found 10 stone pillars, 5 to 11 feet tall, where sacrifices were offered. Also found were many jars containing the remains of children who had been sacrificed to Baal. The whole area turned out to be a cemetery for newborn babies. And they would take the newborn infants and offer them up in sacrifice and put them in jars, the remains in jars, that were sacrificed to Baal. And you wonder, is it any wonder after all this that God had them
created?
Now also under the rubbish of all of this, the remains of this, he found images and plaques of Ashtoreth with sex organs exaggerated to stimulate lust and sensual feelings. So they found images of Ashtoreth and plaques and so forth with Ashtoreth's image on them, and all the sex organs exaggerated to stimulate lust and sensual feelings get people in a state to worship this way. And of course the worship consisted of perverted orgies, with the temples being centers of prostitution. Just completely opposite of what God, you know, God's way is. Just, you know, just 180 degrees opposite, and as far away from God as you can get. Now, another practice that they discovered was what they called foundation sacrifices that the Canaanites practiced. foundation sacrifices. This is when they were building a house. Now, foundation sacrifice, when they build a house, when a family would build a new house, the family would sacrifice one of its children and build its body into the wall to bring good luck to the family. As they were building the wall up, they would sacrifice one of their children and bury the body within the wall. And this would bring good luck to the house and so forth.
Just in the paper about a month or two ago, I saw a human sacrifice.
Oh, really? Is that in this country or?
Danger of Russia. Yeah, oh. Texas was it. We had some hope.
Unbelievable. It's the same devil, same working the same things over and over again. Apparently, I don't know for sure. They apparently couldn't tell. It was just one of the children in the family. I would assume it would be the firstborn, but maybe not. Many of these houses were found at Gezer, also at Jericho, Megiddo, and several other cities. They found these houses with the bodies of the children buried in the walls.
Megiddo?
Megiddo, M-E-G-I-D-D-O, Megiddo. So, archaeology makes it quite clear why God destroyed the Canaanites. The only wonder is that he didn't do it sooner. And one thing to recognize always is all God's ways are right. All God's ways are right. If God would have allowed those Canaanites to continue in existence and try to coexist with the Israelites, you can see, in fact, because the Israelites didn't destroy them completely, they had problems from then on. And they were continuing going back and worshiping these false gods and having problems all the way through. And if they would have completely wiped them out, like God told them did to in the first place, they would have been a lot better off. But God's ways are right. And see, in those days, it's not a time where the gospel is being preached and so forth, and they have to deal with them just the way they are. There's mercy for the children to be killed too, lest they grow up. And apparently, the perversion was so bad it was instilled in them right from the shot children. You know, it's hard to change once they're brought up that way.
What I learned in my study on Kings of Israel and Judges class is that they were obedient to God and slew them right in the beginning, men, women, and children. You see, then this would have prevented the Canaanites and the future generations from rising up and killing thousands of Israelites. But what happened is the Israelites, they negotiated and they compromised.
Yeah.
They had pity that, hey, well, look, you know, I mean, you know, let's don't go so hard on these guys. I mean, let's let a few thousand of them live, you know. We kill thousands of them. Let's let the last few bit of them remain. We just want to show them that we're good guys. We aren't all that bad. So we are merciful. And then in the next two or three generations, the Canaanites rose up to be a great mighty army, see? Since the Israelites left, the last 2,000 or 3,000 of them remained, and they came back and just started killing thousands of Israelites about 200 or 300 years later. Thousands of Israelites. So bloodshed would have been 20 if they just wiped them out right there.
And even the worst part of the thing was the religious, the perverted corruption, you know, the influence spiritually that they had upon them. Okay, we're going to talk about the period of the kings now for a while. The next area we'll move into. Period of the kings. We know that we don't have too much on the period of the judges because there's just not a lot of archaeological information discovered during that period. So moving into the time of the kings, and most of you, well, we know about the city, the place Shiloh that's spoken of as the place where the tabernacle was set up. And I'll give you some references for that. The tabernacle was set up in Shiloh during the period of the kings, just before that time, Joshua 18:1. Joshua 18, well, I'll give you several references here. We're not going to take time to look them up now. It's pretty clear. But Joshua 18:1, the tabernacle was set up in Shiloh. This is during the period of the judges, or Joshua, and even before the period of the judges. Then later on, 1 Samuel 1:3, another reference to Shiloh, says that Israel went to Shiloh to sacrifice. So apparently, because they're going there to sacrifice, apparently the tabernacle is still in Shiloh at that time in 1 Samuel 1:3. Then later on in 2 Samuel 6:15, we find that David brought the ark to Jerusalem. He brought the ark to Jerusalem. And that was in about 1000 B.C. 1000 B.C., the ark to Jerusalem, and that we find in 2 Samuel 6:15. And then in Jeremiah 7, verses 12 to 15, Jeremiah 7, verses 12 to 15. It refers to Shiloh being destroyed. Shiloh being destroyed. Jeremiah 7, verses 12 to 15. It refers to the event that took place. And so apparently what we gather from all this is that Shiloh was an important city from the time of Joshua up to David's time. And then some time after that it was destroyed. As we see at David's time, the ark was still there, and they'd gone, Israel had gone down there to sacrifice, and way back at Joshua's time, the tabernacle was set up there. So presumably, from what we have in the scriptures, Shiloh was an important city, or an important location anyway, and the tabernacle had been there, and the Israelites had gone there to worship up until the time of David, or shortly thereafter, sometime after the time of David, Shiloh was destroyed. Now, the archaeologists have confirmed this again in 1931. A Danish expedition excavated Shiloh and showed, this is a Danish expedition, 1922 to 1931, they excavated Shiloh, it showed the occupation level, or they showed that Shiloh had been occupied from about 1200 to 1050 BC with an Israelite culture, but not afterward. So from 1200 to 1050 BC, apparently Shiloh was occupied with an Israelite culture, and then apparently was destroyed somewhere around 1050. In fact, Albright says that it was destroyed in 1050 BC. But this fits the Bible data perfectly, because this would be the time of David. And 1200, see, this would be getting back around the time of Joshua, or a little bit later. Of course, 14 is a little bit later. It's in the period of the Judges. But the tabernacle had been set up there earlier, and possibly during this time, you know, more people began to live there and became a city. And so this fits right in with the biblical account there, the fact that Shiloh was an important city during this time, and then somewhere near or shortly after the time of David was destroyed. So that's just another kind of a circumstantial type confirmation. Now we know that Saul was the first king of Israel. He was of the tribe of Benjamin. God didn't necessarily want them to have a king, but they demanded a king, so God gave them one. And Saul became the first king of Israel. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. His hometown was in Gibeah in Benjamin. Gibeah. G-I-B-E-A-H. Gibeah in Benjamin. Maybe we've got a map. Right in this area, though. Gibeah in Benjamin was his hometown. It wasn't a very big town. It was about 4 miles north of Jerusalem. And this site of Gibeah is now called Tel El-Ful, if you will. Tel El-Ful. And this was excavated by Albright. We've seen his name quite often. Albright excavated this area of Gibeah in 1922. And again in 1933, and discovered some interesting things. So Gibeah was the hometown of Saul, first king of Israel, in the tribe of Benjamin, and this site was excavated in 1922 and in 1933 by Albright. Now, you can put down 1 Samuel 10:26 as a reference there, the fact that Gibeah was Saul's hometown. It says Saul went home to Gibeah. 1 Samuel 10:26. Now in these excavations, Saul's fortress was found and identified as being Saul's, his fortress in his hometown, fortification for protection for the king, and it turned out to be measured 170 by 155 feet. And it had 6 foot thick walls. 6 foot thick walls and corner towers in this fortress. They found it had two stories and had a large stone staircase inside. 6 foot thick walls, corner towers. Most of you have seen these towers that they had the corners of the walls for the watchmen and so forth. And had two stories with large stone staircase. Must have been quite an experience, you know, to be walking through this house of Saul, the first king of Israel. Now also we find that Saul didn't have a very pleasant end because he turned against God and wasn't walking right before the Lord. And we find 1 Samuel 31 verses 8 to 10. If you read that account there, we find that Saul was killed in 1 Samuel 31, 8 to 10. I guess I'll just, don't take time to turn it to it, but I'll read it to you real quickly. You have the reference and I'll read it. First Samuel 31:8. And it came to pass on the morrow when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent it into the land of the Philistines round about to publish it in the house of their idols and among the people. And they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-Shan. Okay? So they put his armor in the house of Ashtaroth. And it was in the town of Beth-Shan. Now, the archaeologists, I guess I'll give one more verse too. First Chronicles 10:10. Also with that, it tells you a little bit more about this, and they said that they fastened his head in the house of Dagon. They put Saul's head in the house of Dagon, and they put his body and his armor in the temple of Ashtoreth in Beth-Shan. Now, archaeology has confirmed this in an interesting way. Of course, they haven't found Saul's body and head and so forth, but they have found that in the town of Beth-Shan, where it says that this took place, a University of Pennsylvania museum expedition in 1921 to 1930 uncovered Beth-Shan, the ruins of Beth-Shan, and there they found the ruins of a temple of Ashtoreth and the temple of Dagon in the stratum of about dating from about 1000 BC, which is right at the right time. So dating from 1000 BC, they did find a temple of Ashtoreth and they found a temple of Dagon, which confirms what the Bible says, that Saul's armor was put in the temple of Ashtoreth and his head was put in the temple of Dagon, and they did find the temple of Ashtoreth and the temple of Dagon right there at the right time in the right place. So such buildings did exist and at that time and place, and so it certainly is possible this could have taken place. Just kind of taking little bits and pieces here during this time and interesting things that have been confirmed by archaeology. Okay. Now, also put down 1 Samuel 28, verses 3, 7, and 8. This is another area concerning Saul. 1 Samuel 28, verses 3, 7, and 8. This is where Saul was consulting the witch of Endor. Most of you remember the account. Saul was trying to get some information about a battle and things, and God wouldn't tell him anything because he wasn't walking right with God. And so he decided to go to the witch of Endor. And he'd already had all the witches put out of the land, but apparently there was one left. And he consulted the witch of Endor, and he was expecting to have the spirit of Samuel brought up from the dead. As it turned out, God apparently did an unusual thing there and actually did bring up Samuel to speak with him, and the witch didn't recognize her spirit medium. You know, she was afraid. It wasn't her normal spirit medium, so she was terrified too. But Saul was consulting this witch of Endor. Now, archaeology confirms the existence of witches, sorcery, and occultism at that time. There were a lot of witches and witchcraft and sorcery at that time, and archaeology has proved that. So again, we have an interesting confirmation of this account. And it's not a direct confirmation, but it belies all the claims of the liberals that they'll try to, you know, their usual argument goes about like this. Well, there couldn't have been any witches back at that time, so it couldn't have happened. I don't know if they ever made that argument here, but I'm sure you can probably find that out someplace. That's just a standard way of approaching things. But they did find evidence of these things existing. In fact, the Hittite texts, the Hittite sources discovered by Winkler, remember we talked about Winkler who discovered the Hittites? Well, he discovered these tablets, some 20,000 tablets, I believe, of the Hittites and reconstructed their history. This is in 1906. He showed that in Asia Minor, in the second millennium B.C., magic and occult practices were carried on, especially by old women called sibyls or seers. Especially by old women. Old women seem to be the ones that were involved in it most. Sibyls or seers. And throughout Asia Minor, which was the area where the Hittites had lived, the Hittite Empire was, and it was during the same time, second millennium B.C., so we're talking about from 1000 to 2000 B.C. And a number of their rituals are even recorded. So it was especially old women. That's kind of interesting in view of fact what we see here. Old women were also used as oracles among the Assyrians centuries later. Even later among the Assyrians, they had old women used as oracles for their gods and so forth. Of course, probably demon-possessed. So not only is the existence of sorcery and occults confirmed, but also the fact that old women were involved, and this is what Saul was consulting the old witch of Endor. Yes. Witchcraft was common, you know, back in those times, and even all the way up in the first century. You find out in the Book of Acts, you know, they're running into witches and the occult thing too. And it was quite popular during the Roman Empire, and of course, on through the Catholic ages too. Okay, let's talk about David a little bit. Now, from David, these are just a few confirmations that come in by the wayside here, and there's a lot of interesting things that are confirmed by archaeology. And 2 Samuel 5:7 is a reference. This just states that David took Jerusalem from the Jebusites. 2 Samuel 5:7. David, when he took over as king, he conquered the Jebusites and drove them out of the land. And conquered Jerusalem, which was the city whose ancient name was Jebus, which was after the Jebusites. And so, or the Jebusites is that the name of the city. And he took the city of Jerusalem from the Jebusites and set it up as his city, the city of David. Now, Jerusalem was considered an impregnable city because it was located on a high plateau about 2,500 feet above sea level. Jerusalem was a very high city, located way at a very high level, 2,500 feet above sea level. And 3,800 feet above the Dead Sea, which is not very far away. So here's Jerusalem. The Dead Sea down here is minus 290 feet. It's 290 feet below sea level. And Jerusalem is 2,500 feet above sea level, about. And so you can see quite a tremendous difference, 3,800 feet about, difference between the level of the Dead Sea and Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem, located high on a hill like this, It had a natural rock defense as well, and it had its walls and gates and towers. It was very hard to get to, you know, troops coming uphill like that and trying to storm a city on the top of a hill. It's very difficult because the guys can just stand on the walls there and start throwing rocks down at them and rolling things down at them. It would be really hard to take a city like that. And so Jerusalem was considered impregnable. That's one of the reasons it lasted so long, I'm sure. When Jericho and a lot of other cities fell to the Canaanites, to the Israelites when they came in, Jerusalem held fast for quite some time. But nevertheless, David did take the city. Didn't tell you all the details about it, but it must have been quite a campaign. He took the city of Jerusalem and set it up as his own city. And the old city of Jerusalem has been excavated. The old city of David, the excavation of the old city of David was primarily the work of John Garsang again. Remember, he's the one that excavated Jericho. Garstang, and also J.W. Crowfoot. Sounds like an Indian. But he succeeded Garstang's work and finished that for him. So it was Garstang and Crowfoot who were excavating the city, Old City of David. Now they found portions of the old Jebusite city wall and fortification, and including the Great Western Gate. So they found some of the old ancient Jebusite city wall and part of the Western Gate had been uncovered. Apparently, the city of David, the city that David took at the time, was shaped somewhat like a human footprint. It was kind of narrow on one end and, you know, kind of like this. And it turned out to be 1,250 feet long. Now, this is a city that we're talking about. Only 1,250 feet long, which is about a quarter of a mile or so, and 400 feet wide. So the total walled space contained no more than 8 acres. 8 acres within the wall. See, when we talk about these ancient cities, we're not talking about big giant metropolises. You know, when we talk about Babylon, that's quite a bit bigger, but needless to say, it's 60 miles circumference around the city. But here, the city of Jebusite city of Jerusalem, the ancient Jerusalem, was only 8 acres. That's about the whole city is about a little bit bigger than the property that we have here for the church facilities, you know, including the parking lot and the whole works.
Wow!
So it's not that huge. Of course, it rapidly expanded after that, but this is the walled part, too. I'm sure there were houses and things outside the walls. But the fortified area was only about as big, a little bit bigger than our facilities here. But because of its ideal location, it was a natural choice of David for the nation's capital, because it was so high. It was the highest of all the cities, and it was a natural location for defense purposes and everything, for the location for the capital.
Was that the name of the time of Christ?
No, this is just way back at the time of David. No, by the time of Christ, it's much bigger than that. This is just at the time of David, after they'd taken it over from the Canaanites. So as soon as David had taken it over, of course, he started building, and you know, it was much bigger after that. But just at the time David took it. Okay. Now, let's talk about Solomon a little bit, too. There are a lot of other things you can be looking up on these things, but I want to just give you some of the main points that archaeology has to show by way of interest on these things. Solomon, King Solomon. Now, we read a lot about Solomon in the book of Kings and the things that he had and the riches that he had. I'll just give you some references here, and then we'll talk about some of the things that archaeology has also discovered. 1 Kings 10, verses 26 and 28. 1 Kings 10, verses 26 and 28, and 1 Kings 9, verses 15 to 19. 1 Kings 9, verses 15 to 19. These verses mention Solomon's stables and his chariot cities. Solomon had a lot of horses and stables for the horses, and he had actual cities that were what he called chariot cities, where he would keep his chariots and stables and horses and so forth. And some of the cities that are mentioned here in these scripture references are Megiddo. These are mentioned as chariot cities: Megiddo, Gezer, and Hazor.
What?
Yes.
Does that Megiddo have anything to do with like Armageddon?
Yes, it's in the same area. It's the Valley of Megiddo, and so forth. It's located in the same area. So Armageddon, it does come from that. That's right. So Megiddo, Gezer, and Hazor, all these cities were mentioned in the scriptures as Solomon's chariot cities. Now, excavations of these three cities. Now, there were other cities mentioned, too, but these three were mentioned, and these three have been excavated. So, excavations of these three cities have confirmed the existence of horses and chariots there. And we'll talk about Megiddo. That's one of the more striking ones for this comparison here. Dr. Henry Breasted, B-R-E-A-S-T-E-D, Dr. Henry Breasted, in 1925-1934, uncovered the ruins of Solomon's stables at Megiddo. And many times you might find pictures of this in different archaeology books, but it uncovered the ruins of Solomon's stables at Megiddo. The group of stables held at least 450 horses and about 150 chariots.
1,500 horses?
450 horses, and 150 chariots. The stables included stone hitching posts and mangers out of which the horses were fed. So they found the stables and hitching posts for the stones, and it held at least 450 horses and about 150 chariots in this one area. This is just the ruins that they found. It could have been even more in the ghetto, in different stages, but this is what was discovered. The plan and the architecture of the buildings was definitely characteristic of Solomon, and may well have been designed by the architects of Hiram of Tyre, who designed Solomon's temple. Remember that Solomon went to Hiram of Tyre and hired him. Tyre was located up here, and Hiram of Tyre was the one who built the temple and built some of the other buildings for Solomon. And the architecture of these stables is very similar to that. So there's quite a lot of reason to believe that they were built at the same time, and they represent actual Solomon's actual stables. Of course, there would be anyone else's anyway. Anyone else mentioned to have these. Now, similar stables are also found at Hazor and Gezer, these other two cities. So all three cities have evidence of this. Okay, now second thing concerns Solomon's gold. We're told about the riches and the gold and so forth that Solomon had. And there's kind of an interesting confirmation of this. Kind of a roundabout way, but it is interesting. We find that in 1 Kings 10, if you read verses 10 to 23 in there, 1 Kings 10, verses 10 to 23, you read the account of Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon, and at the time of the divided kingdom, Rehoboam and Jeroboam split, of course. Jeroboam took the northern 10 tribes, and Rehoboam had the southern 3 tribes. And Rehoboam was not walking with God and began backbiting and so forth, and wasn't doing what God told him to do. And about 5 years after Solomon's death, when Rehoboam was ruling, Shishak, king of Egypt, came and took away all Solomon's gold and took it away from Rehoboam. Shishak, king of Egypt. So Rehoboam, of course, had the gold of Solomon and everything. In fact, they had huge golden shields that were in the temple and so forth that were made of all this gold. And Shishak came and took it away. And you can read about that in 1 Kings 14, verses 25 to 27 also. Let me just look that up real quick. 1 Kings 14, verses 25 to 27. I didn't go so fast. And it came to pass in the 5th year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house. He took away all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. And King Rehoboam made in their stead brazen shields, and committed them unto the hands of the chief of the guard, which kept the door of the king's house. So Rehoboam lost the gold shields, so he had some brass ones made, you know, so he feel good about it, you know. There used to be a piece of shield there. It looked almost like gold. It was pretty pathetic. But Shishak's mummy was discovered. Now Shishak's the one who came and took the gold, remember, according to the scriptures. His mummy was discovered intact in his burial chamber at Tanis, Egypt. Tanis is another one of the towns where they buried pharaohs. Tanis, Egypt, and they discovered it in 1938 to 39. Discovered his mummy, and the sarcophagus was covered with gold. The sarcophagus was covered with gold, which is not a normal thing.
What does that mean?
That means his coffin. That's the box in which he was buried. And possibly some of Solomon's gold there, the gold that he had there, was very possibly some of the gold that was taken out of the temple in Jerusalem that belonged to Solomon. It must be really interesting to discover some of these things and realize where they probably came from.
Was gold not common in Egypt?
Well, apparently it was an unusual thing for them to have their sarcophagus and things. I'm sure they had gold, but you know, it took a lot of gold to cover something like it. Mm-hmm. Apparently it was solid gold, so it's... It was just covered with, you know, the whole thing covered with gold, and it's pretty vivid, you know. Shishak kind of stands out there with his golden sarcophagus, and he's the one who went in and took Solomon's gold, so it's quite a high probability that it is Solomon's gold. Mm-hmm. Also, Shishak's triumphal inscription at Karnak gives lists of conquests, including towns in all parts of Judah. So they found inscriptions by Shishak in Egypt, in Karnak, Egypt, K-A-R-N-A-K, giving lists of all his conquests. And things, and I'm sure a lot of this is exaggerated, but he does include mentions of towns in all parts of Judah. And of course, the Bible tells us that Shishak came into Judah, and it mentions him taking several different towns. That's why I give you that first reference in King. And again, confirming what the scriptural account was on this. Also, part of Shishak's stela was discovered at Megiddo, proving that he took that city. Also, this is also stated in the Karnak inscription. So he took Megiddo, apparently, and they found his, part of his stela. They usually set up a stela, which is a little obelisk-type stone there, commemorating, telling, you know, how great the pharaoh was and how he took all this and so forth. A stela was S-T-E-L-E. S-T-E-L-E. It was just a little obelisk there that was commemorating his victory. Now, these things were noted for their lies and their exaggerations of the situation. So what he said there probably wasn't complete truth. It probably wasn't as stunning a victory as he might have indicated. But nevertheless, the presence of Estella there does indicate that he was there and that he, you know, did wage battle there.
Where was that from?
In Megiddo, which is one of the cities of Judah in Palestine. So we know that Shishak was there, and we know that his coffin is covered with gold. It's very possibly Solomon's gold. Okay, now, also, the Bible talks about Solomon's navy in 1 Kings 9, verse 26. 1 Kings 9, 26. read it real quickly. And King Solomon made a navy of ships in Ethion Geber, which is beside Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. So Solomon made a navy of ships. And these ships were made for trade with Africa, India, and Arabia. I know we're hitting a lot of things here. I'm trying to get the information to you so you don't have it. Now, Ethion Geber was located right at the top of the Red Sea, right here, on the Gulf of Aqaba. It's right here in the north. Ezion Geber. Put it down here.
Was located.
Geber. This is a city located right here. It's actually in Edom. And it says that Solomon built ships there, and he had them stationed there for trade. It didn't mention trade here, but it's pretty obvious that this is what the reason for it was. And so, of course, having a port on the Red Sea, you know, he could trade with Africa and other areas, Arabia and so forth, and have his goods transported and have other goods transported to him. We're out of time here, but next time we'll talk about this. I hope after the exam we may have some time to finish up a little of this. But I think in 1 hour we'll be able to finish pretty well the last time. So the final exam will cover right up to this point, right up to Solomon's Navy. And everything since, what was it? What did we say? From Solomon the Moor up to Solomon's Navy for next time.
A lot of need to cover today.
Yeah, we got a lot of things in. So we're doing all right. But it's just that I won't be able to give you the full exam that I wanted to give you. I'll have to cut out some of the questions, but that'll be all right. I don't think you'll mind. In fact, I may just give you automatic credit for some of it, so it's kind of hard to lose. Well, we're going to get to that next time, but they found Solomon's copper refinery there and showed that he had big refineries in there for producing different, manufacturing different items like nails and furnaces, spearhead, fish hooks, and other things that were exported back there to the natives. It would be logical to have the ships there now for all this equipment that he found. Quite a fantastic thing that they found there, apparently.
Michael, Jerusalem?
I can't remember. I've seen some maps of it. I think it's on the northern end of it, though. I'm not positive. Oh, no, it's kind of surrounded by the other city. It's kind of within the city. They got the walls there, and the modern Jerusalem is kind of all around it. Yes. We got these at the University of Washington.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Hey, I'll show you something, Mike.
I just want to show you something.
Yeah. Pardon me, senor. Mm-hmm. Will you show you something? your eyes are going to plug out and everything else. My brother lent me this. He's going to give me a copy of this for Christmas. Mm-hmm. Now, my brother's got a big collection of Rome, ones on Rome and pagan and all the early Christianity symbols. See, look at this. Let me just show you something here.
I wish I had these before.
Really? But you know who all these kings are.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see, let me just get this out. This is the inside of the Persian capital.
That's a picture of the cake.
Oh, you can mimeograph this out there.
You know, this is something I want to show Steve, because when he teaches again, he might be able to take some photographs of the pictures here and make slides of them. We've done that before. Works pretty good. It looks really good.
Didn't they dug up?
That
whole
thing? Yeah. And then,
It's
a big time, boy. It is. This whole foot by foot. These books are photo pictures. In here, they got stone lines, and they got.
Book this assignment. Make sure that you take this assignment with you and the assignment that's due next week, and we'll finish correcting this one, and we will also correct the new one next week. Okay? I'll be there. Yeah. get a lot of light. You get a lot of light.